In this Wonderlust Friday Forum, recorded at the Bozeman Public Library on September 14, 2018, as part of the Our Yellowstone collaboration featuring Yellowstone National Park historian, now retired, Lee Whittlesey, discusses the 10 top events in the history of Yellowstone National Park. He is introduced by Friday Forum host Eva Patton.
Our speaker today, part of the Yellowstone series and the Friday Forum speaker, almost needs no introduction. I'm sure many of you have read his books, like, for instance, Death in Yellowstone. He's the author of 12 books as the historian in the park, and he's working on three more. He had a 50-year career in Yellowstone Park, starting as a bus driver, so you never know. And he moved up and became an attorney, a lawyer, has a law degree. So he really needs no introduction, and his books are available. Lee retired from the Park Service and is now living in Livingston. So he's one of our neighbors, and we have him to enjoy here in Bozeman. Many of you also know him when he got an honorary doctorate from Montana State University a few years ago. Lee.
This is a talk that I have given to historians for a number of years. Can I use any of these markers? And what I'm going to talk about today is the top 10 events in the history of Yellowstone. So this is a nice, easy way to learn what the most important, I think. Historians have largely agreed with me on this top 10. I only had one historian through the years who did not agree, and he sort of gave me a little bit of trouble about why the Nez Perce foray through Yellowstone was not included. The criteria that I've used to select these top 10 have been and is twofold. One, did it affect great numbers of people? And number two, did it affect the park dramatically? Those are my criteria. And because of those two criteria, I settled upon this list of 10. And the first one occurred before Yellowstone was a park. A massive slaughter of animals in the park, and we know the years now. It occurred beginning in 1871 and lasted to 1884. I will tell you why we know the years shortly. So that's the first one. The second one is the establishment of Yellowstone, right? And some of you might even know that year, right? 72. Yes, establishment of YNP, and it's 1872. And we're going to move to arrival of the railroad. In this case, we're talking about the Northern Pacific Railroad. It arrived at the north entrance, a little town called Cinnabar, Montana Territory, 1883. I wrote a book about that little town, Cinnabar. The book is called Gateway to Yellowstone. I'm real proud of that book, by the way, because it's a fascinating story about the people who started that Montana town on the Montana frontier, who had been here since the glorious halcyon days of 1862 in Bannock and 1863 in Virginia City. Those are near and dear to us. Those of you who know Montana history, because that's really, except for Fort Benton, those places are really where the state got started. Of course, Fort Benton's 1846, and we call it the birthplace of Montana for that reason. But it was there a long time before the gold rushes got the rest of us here. And I'm sure some of you have ancestors who got here in 62 in Bannock or 63 in Virginia City. Number four, and of course that really affected Yellowstone, those places. Arrival of the U.S. Army into Yellowstone. Anybody know what year that was? Anybody know?
86.
Very good. Number five is the Lacey Act. Some of you may not know what it was.
04.
A good guess. 94. 94. And I think the reason you're saying 04 is because there was a second Lacey Act. And you're right, there was a second Lacey Act, and it people get those confused. And both were named for Senator Lacey out of Iowa. But 94 is the Yellowstone one. The first wildlife statute in the nation. Which strangely was federal. Because as we know, and I'll tell you more about it when we get there, the states have jurisdiction over animals. Right? Not the feds. Except in Yellowstone. Number six, the mission of the automobile, 1915. Number seven, establishment of the National Park Service. Number eight, the Leopold Report. Actually, related to Aldo Leopold and his son Starker. Starker Leopold really was the mover and the shaker in this case. Number nine is the Great Fires, I will call them. And of course, people say, which fire? Anybody know the year I'm talking about? Everybody knows that one. 1988. Been talking about it a lot recently as a 30-year anniversary. Is it 30? And the last one. Anybody have a guess for what the last one is?
Wolves.
Wolves is right. That's your pet one, right? Now? What year are we talking about here?
95
is correct. Okay, that's the 10. So, we have the massive slaughter of animals.
We're talking about the slaughter of animals. This event actually began in the summer of 1871 before the park was established. We have documented information on massive killing of park animals during this period by regional hunters. Hunting was, of course, actually legal in Yellowstone until 1883. So in that very early time, anybody could walk in and shoot animals. But these people killed massive numbers way beyond what was required for food. Everybody in the region, especially in southern Montana, was trying to make a living. And as you know, those of you who live here, making a living here has virtually always been kind of a ramshackle, haphazard affair that we dabble in a bunch of different things. So people dabbled in mining. They dabbled a little bit in wheat raising or hay, selling hay, farming some, short of growing season, some cattle ranching, quite a bit of that actually, dairying, and then the hospitality institution. Those are the kinds of jobs that people dabbled in and still do here in Montana. Everybody was cobbling it all together to get to stay here, and that's kind of what we still do today. Everybody's going to hard scrabble about. I love that 19th century word. Hard scrabbling about to make a living in order to get to stay here. And we still do that. So, while there was some legitimate food gathering in this hunting, these hunters often slaughtered animals just for target practice or greed or because they were sure the region was never going to run out of animals. Thomas Jefferson said he thought it would take 650 years. To settle the American West. It took about 50. So there are a number of accounts like this one from 1875 by General Strong, who passed through the park that summer. And he said, in 1870, when Lieutenant Doan, my friend, first entered the Yellowstone Basin, it was no doubt a country that was unsurpassed on this continent for big game. Remember, he wrote this in 1875. Large herds of elk, mountain sheep, the black and white-tailed deer, and the grizzly cinnamon and black bears were numerous. The Yellowstone Valley, that would be Paradise Valley, right east of here, was swarming with antelope, and the mountain lion was frequently killed. During the past 5 years, the large game has been slaughtered here by professional hunters by thousands and for their hides alone. An elk skin is worth from $6 to $8, and it is said that when the snow is deep and the herd gets confused, one hunter will frequently kill from 25 to 50 of these noble animals in a day. In a day, over 4,000 were killed last winter by professional hunters in the Mammoth Springs Basin alone. Their carcasses and branching antlers can be seen on every hillside and in every valley. The terrible slaughter, which has been going on since the fall of 1871, has thinned out the great bands of big game until it is a rare thing now to see an elk, deer, or mountain sheep along the regular trail from Bozeman to Yellowstone Lake. So even by 1875, they were that we were seeing along the main trails in the park, if anything was a main trail at that time, that there had been a decrease in animals. And I got to tell you, when I first came to Yellowstone, as a kid in his 20s, sitting on the bar stools in Gardner, talking to old-timers, I was trying to find old-timers to talk to them at that time when a lot of the rest of my friends were drinking a little more than I wanted to do when there was an old-timer present. Don't get me wrong, I had my share of partying in the 20s like so many of us, but I talked to these old-timers, and one of them in particular told me, you know, my granddaddy drove stagecoach here in 1883, and he told me that there were hardly any animals here then. And as I studied and learned and marveled about the strangeness of that, it became apparent to me that granddaddy had been right. But what granddaddy didn't know was that there had been massive animals before then, and that a lot of them had been killed by 83 when the railroad arrived. How do we know about this? Well, some of you might know my friend Paul Schillery. He wrote some of the great books of Yellowstone. He and I wrote a book together called Myth and History and the Creation of Yellowstone. And he's written Searching for Yellowstone, which I think is one of the five most important books written about Yellowstone, just my opinion. He and I spent 25 years searching for every possible history account of what early travelers saw in the way of animals in Yellowstone. And it took 25 years to find 511 actual accounts, what we historians call primary source documents, because they were written at that time, not later by some professor trying to look back. They're written at that time. So they carry great credibility. Like Johnny Cash sang in 1957, I was there when it happened, so I guess I ought to know. Now that carries a lot of weight with historians. They're called primary source documents. Might be published in the newspaper, might be a handwritten letter, might be in a typewritten letter. The typewriter was there beginning in 1876, approximately. So these accounts that tell us what someone did at that time are very valuable to historians. They carry a lot more weight than, say, a book I wrote in 1995. I wasn't there, right? So we found 511 accounts. We wrote a two-volume book about it. It's called The History of Mammals of Yellowstone National Park. That book is right now in review. The third professional historian that the Park Service, it's a Park Service book, hired, is just finishing up his review of it. And as soon as he emails it to me, I will take his and the other two and coalesce those comments into the manuscript, give it to Paul Schillery, who will do a final once-over of it, and then it goes to the publisher. It's a two-volume book, so you're probably not going to want to read it cover to cover. Volume one is about every account we found quoting it. They tell us what those people saw, including 80 observations of wolves, historically, hundreds for elk, bears, a whole lot more than you might think for lynx, bobcat, wolverine, the rare animals. That book will come in the next probably year and a half or so, with any luck. That's how we know this stuff. And I got to tell you, there are naysayers out there who are trying to say there weren't any animals in Yellowstone. They're nuts, in my opinion. That's just crazy. It's not only counterintuitive, but it goes against what the original travelers saw. They're beginning in the 1920s, and we've traced all that too. There was this idea that came in that said, you know what, there weren't any animals in Yellowstone. They were all pushed up into there by advancing civilization. Oh, really? The people who wrote those 511 accounts would have been shocked to read that long after they were gone, that their observations had just been forgotten. So that the naysayers were claiming there were no animals. They were pushed up into the mountain region by advancing civilization. As a historian, I immediately say, really? Where was the civilization doing the pushing? Where were those towns? Montana's pretty darn small today. Yellowstone sat there beginning in 1872, but there weren't any towns to speak of around it. Bozeman was the only thing really close, established in 1864, 75 miles away from the north boundary of the park. No place else was there to do the pushing. What's pushing? St. Louis, pushing it. Yeah. Salt Lake City, small town, man. Denver, small town, man. There's nothing there to do that pushing. So I immediately didn't buy it, but we had to prove it by finding these accounts. And those naysayers started telling us back in 1990, or actually 8, as early as 80, you guys can't reintroduce wolves. Wolves weren't native here. Wrong. But that was the push. Okay, we beat them on that one. The next one was elk. There are too many elk, and elk were never native here. There weren't really any elk in Yellowstone. Really? Could surprise any of those observers, the 511 we found, who were there. So we beat them on elk. And now they're trying to beat us with bison. You guys got an unnatural congregation of bison in there because the bison didn't exist in Yellowstone. They were pushed in there by advancing civilization. That would have been a great surprise to the people who actually saw huge numbers of bison, especially in places like Paradise Valley and even in Yellowstone. So that is what I say to the naysayers. If you don't believe me, naysayers, come and read these accounts and you'll be able to very soon. This is the story of the massive slaughter that lasted up to 1884. And by the way, Montana was one of, if not the very last places in the country where the bison disappeared. They were almost all gone by 80, 81, 82, but Montana still had them in 84. And we have that on good evidence, documentary evidence. It's also our opinion, Paul's and mine, that some species of animals such as the mountain lion and wolverine never recovered from this slaughter. Interestingly, the skunk was one of those animals that was also massively slaughtered. Superintendent Norris talked of killing more than 400 skunks at Mammoth Hot Springs so that his men could sleep peacefully. Today it is hard to find a single skunk in the park, and if you see a skunk in Yellowstone, it's a rare animal sighting, and you're supposed to fill out the form. I saw one a year ago, Christmas Day, in Gardner with snow on the ground right at the arch. The first one I'd ever seen in Gardner. We'd had a few that, you know, one of them got my dog up against the hillside on the north side of Yellowstone River in Gardner, but I'd never seen one on the south side. And here it was, right at the arch. I took a picture of it, which for me is kind of a challenge. And then I called the park and told them it was there. I reported and did my duty, reported the rare animal. Does anyone in the room want to spearhead the drive for skunk reintroduction in Yellowstone? Now, I got to tell you, that's a pretty interesting proposition to think about when we consider things we probably ought to be doing if I were still working for the National Park Service and I were true to my green and gray roots, as we say. I would want to spearhead that drive to reintroduce the skunk. Might not go over too well. But you know, all animals arguably have a place in the ecosystem. Okay, so that's the long story about the first one. Number two, the establishment of the park, March 1, 1872. Of course, this would be a top 10 event for Yellowstone on nearly everyone's list. The best account of the complex events which led to the park's establishment, in my opinion, is Aubrey Haynes's book, Yellowstone National Park, Its Exploration and Establishment. That book is now out of print and hard to find, but it's available completely on the internet. I did some Googling to find it. Aubrey Haynes, H-A-I-N-E-S, and the book is Yellowstone National Park, Its Exploration and Establishment. That was his earlier book, published in 1974. If you read it on the internet or wherever, be sure you read the endnotes, because he's got almost as much information in his endnotes as in the main text. You'll miss a lot of goodies if you don't read the endnotes. So, the park was established by Congress following the 1870 explorations of the Washburn-Langford-Doane expedition. Mr. Langford's story of how those explorers sat around a campfire at present Madison Junction and discussed the supposed preservation of the place has been called untrue by a number of historians, including us, Paul Schleri and I. And we wrote a whole book about that. The book is Myth and History of the Creation of Yellowstone. We also learned that well-enshrined, cherished myths have a way of outliving the historians who debunk them. And we fully expect that that myth, that story, enshrined on arguably a place of honor in great stories, will probably outlive us. But if you're interested in that book, it's called Myth and History and the Creation of Yellowstone. A variety of scholars objected that Mr. Langford's campfire story ignored known pre-1870 proposals that Yellowstone should be set aside as a public park, that the process by which Yellowstone was established did not seem to spring directly or indirectly from any such campfire alleged conversation, and that the public-spirited sentiments attributed to these supposed park founders were only one of the impulses driving their actions, another being the fact that Superintendent Langford, he was trying to make the place safe for the Northern Pacific Railroad to come. So regardless of its authenticity, this myth will probably continue to be with us for many years, that story. Number three, arrival of the Northern Pacific Railroad. This was the event that really kicked Yellowstone into tourism gear from the perspective of visitors finally being able to reach it. Because in the 1870s, if you went to Yellowstone, you did it on horseback or muleback, pulling a pack string the way some trips are still done. It's a great way to truly see the park in the backcountry if you get a chance. And as we get older, those horses sound better and better. They're expensive, but worth it, in my opinion. If you can scrape up the money, it's a great way to see the backcountry. But I got to tell you, nine of us and I went hiking in Beckler in August, 4 days, all the way back to Ferris Fork, the whole 28-mile round trip. Carried the pack, and I'm 68 years old. It darn near killed me. But I made it. And, of course, it was a real treat to see all the young guys that were there with us, my daughter included, who's 24. It's amazing what you might be able to do when you think you can't do it anymore. Be optimistic. So the railroad, anyway, arrived in 1883. And prior to that time, there were only 500 to about 1,000 horseback or muleback visitors per year. The year the railroad arrived, suddenly 5,000 visitors. Everybody wanted to come to Yellowstone. Everybody from President Arthur, who came that year, all the way down through the ranks of senators, chief justices of the Supreme Court. Morrison Waite was the justice who came. General Sherman, General Sheridan, famous people then. Went to Yellowstone. Everybody wanted to see it in 1883, and now suddenly you could. Suddenly, the trains ran, and you could go to Yellowstone. It might take you a week to get there from, say, the East Coast, but you could do it. So everybody wanted to step off the train at Cinnabar, Montana Territory. Montana wasn't a state yet. Step off the train into Cinnabar and look. The arch wasn't there. But you could look into what was the park. Train depot wasn't there yet either. And see, this is where I'm heading. Into Wonderland, as they called it. And they started calling it Wonderland in 1871. The term Wonderland is older than the park. It made it into the journalists' notebooks and the newspapers before the park was a park. You should know where the railroad arrived. I think I mentioned it. Came to the north entrance, the park's original entrance, and not to Gardner, to Cinnabar. They couldn't get the land to get the railroad to Gardner. Not until 1902 were the tracks in Gardner. So for almost 20 years, the railhead was in Cinnabar. That's where you got off the train. You got onto a coach, stagecoach, and you would travel around Yellowstone, hot, dusty, and tiring at 6 miles per hour for 5 1/4 days. That was the typical tour. You had time to smell the flowers. You had time to really see things. The average visitor stay today in Yellowstone is a day and a half. And it is the longest, last I heard, longest average visitor stay of any national park in the 400 and whatever we have now, 412, whatever it is, number of national parks in the unit. Because most visitors get out of their car, go into the visitor center, look up at the big heads in South Dakota, buy an ice cream cone, and yow, they're on to the next park. Yellowstone still has this day and a half. That's the longest visitor average stay in the national park system. So Santa Barbara today is a ghost town. They archaeologized it a few years ago and found 1,700 artifacts or something like that, and excavated cellar holes, found the deep basements that were there, found cut up, chopped up animals where people were poaching and eating the animals out of the park, just what you'd expect. There were Army soldiers, by the way, who did that too. Then they buried it all back, because that's the safest way to protect an archaeological site. You bury it all back and it's protected. Some of that stuff came to Montana State University, by the way, and they're still curating it here at MSU. You might also be interested to know the Yellowstone's railroad history is complicated. During the park's heyday from 1927 to 1960, that's the heyday of railroads, actually it would be 1883 to 1960. Five different railroads reached Yellowstone. Of course, the Northern Pacific, with his wonderful advertising campaigns, came to the north entrance beginning in 83. Chicago, Burlington, Quincy came to Cody, Wyoming beginning in 1901. The Union Pacific came to West Yellowstone, Montana in 1907, starting the tours of the park the following year in 08. Gallatin Gateway, what I call the park's northwest entrance, came the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pennsylvania Railroad beginning in 1926. Although the fancy train station at Gallatin Gateway is still there as a restaurant today, did not open until 1927. And the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad came to Lander, Wyoming, beginning in 1921. So all of those railroads served Yellowstone in one form or other, five different railroads. But the Northern Pacific at Cinnabar was the first. Arrival of the U.S. Army in 1886. Prior to the Army's arrival, the park was administered by civilian superintendents and their assistants. There were many problems with this. Visitors and concessioners killed park animals, chipped pieces off geysers for souvenirs, started forest fires, sometimes purposely. We don't like this park being here, because really this is our land, and so by golly, we're just going to set some fires. That goes on in the Park Service throughout the whole system still. Yellowstone, the problem they had with that one was Yellowstone got there before the first settlers, at least before those first settlers got their land signed up for. Yellowstone was established March 1st, 1872 by Congress. Two squatters who had been at Mammoth Hot Springs wanting to sell baths and a little bit of hospitality like a restaurant, hotels, souvenirs. Those two old squatters went to Bozeman. Gallatin County then was the closest place to register your land. So Gallatin County, they came to Bozeman to register their land. Too late. 9 days late. March 10th, 9 days too late. They came to Bozeman March the 10th, 1872, and it was too late. Congress had already acted. They couldn't get rights to the land at Mammoth Hot Springs. So, as of now, and I've spent 40 years studying this, you let me know if you guys find an instance anywhere in the world other than Yellowstone where the park beat the settlers. I can't find it. There's always somebody who wants to say, oh, we got this park in Mongolia. It's older than Yellowstone. No. Well, it beat the settlers. No. So far, every time I look and check it out for such a claim, it's not there. Yellowstone beat the settlers by 9 days. Happened nowhere else in the world that I can find, because the general rule, folks, is the settlers get there first and then they make the parks worldwide, except for Yellowstone. Let me know if you ever find an exception. Call me on the phone, collect. We still do collect today. So, back to the Army. These were chipping pieces off geysers, starting forest fires purposely. They cut trees for building purposes and scribbled their names on geyser formations. These complex administrative difficulties resulted in the U.S. Army's being given the nod to come to Yellowstone in August of 1886. The Army was not supposed to stay very long, but it ended up staying for 32 years. Long time. The Army's extra personnel and money made a great deal of difference in early Yellowstone. Now order could be made out of chaos, and the park's resources could be at least marginally protected. Most historians believe the Army did a generally efficient and effective job of protecting the park during that period, 1886 to 1918, not 16 when the Park Service was established. 18. The Army stayed 2 more years beyond the Park Service was established. For relevant reading, you're interested in that, I'd recommend H. Duane Hampton's book, How the U.S. Cavalry Saved Our National Parks. It's still a classic work. And it also deals with the Army's similar administration of Yosemite, Sequoia, and General Grant National Parks. Moreover, you should know that the Ranger flat hats that the Rangers wear today, that I wore myself for 34 years, have nothing to do with Smokey the Bear. Okay. We call them Smokey the Bear hats sometimes. He didn't come along until like 1943, I think it was, during World War II. Very late. That was the National Park Service's salute to the U.S. Army. That's the U.S. Army campaign hat. The Army had worn those in the Indian Wars. Beginning right after the Civil War, they lost those. Remember the billed Civil War hats you've seen? Especially the ones that the Yankees wore. Blue billed hat with the cross sabers. You can still buy replicas of them. They dumped those and they went to the flat Army hats during the Indian Wars for the next 20 years or so. So that was the Army's campaign hat. That's where the National Park Service got the idea for Smokey the Bear hats. And we're still stuck with the Smokey the Bear title. And by the way, there's at least one very direct remnant of the U.S. Army that's still in Yellowstone today. Those of you who visit the parks or do any hiking or horseback riding and see a Park Service patrol cabin, you might, should you get a chance to visit one of those patrol cabins, you might see the sign in there which reads, "Stop! Have you finished your job before leaving the cabin?" These rules for keeping the cabins clean and getting them ready for the next user are virtually identical to the ones used by the Army. And we have the Army's sign of the rules for cleaning up the cabin and taking care of it. And then we have the later Park Service sign. And they're the same rules, identical verbatim. The Park Service just picked them up and reused them from the Army. And they include leaving plenty of split wood, the dishes clean, the lanterns full, and the mouse traps baited and reset. Very important. You'll eat your sleeping bags. Hang those up in the top of the cabin if you can. Keep the mice away from them. And the last person out is supposed to leave the snow shovel outside the cabin at the last autumn trip so the next user can dig his way in, if necessary, through the deep snow. I was a person who, in the 1990s, skied into the Winter Creek, appropriately named creek, it turned out. Winter Creek Patrol Cabin, and we couldn't find the cabin. Couldn't find it. And I'd been there before. I thought I knew right where the cabin was. Started thinking about it. Thinking, you know what, this cabin is, it's down there. It's buried. There was no shovel. So we started scraping where I thought it was. Missed it the first time, moved over a little, scraped some more. Found it, buried, dug down, found the shovel, and excavated it and spent the night there. There were only 3 of us on that trip. Should have taken more folks. That's a rule. Take more people. Number 5, passage of the Lacey Act. Early 1894, a poacher named Ed Howell, H-O-W-E-L-L, was arrested by U.S. Army soldiers in Pelican Valley after he had skied in to hunt buffalo. Legal to hunt up to this point. Now, bison numbers were extremely low at that time in Yellowstone, less than 50, and they would continue to drop so that by 1902 there was something like 23 documented bison still left in the park. 2 U.S. Army soldiers caught Howell in the act of cutting the heads off 6 buffalo and hanging them in nearby trees so that they would be safe from predators until spring, when he could come back in there, get the full head, and take it to the taxidermist, have it mounted. Taxidermist in Livingston, by the way, the Wittich brothers. We know who they were, where their shop was, and then, of course, pay them the whole bunch of money that they charged even then, and he would have, voila, his trophy of bison heads, or sell them to other folks. This was an old Cook City poacher, Ed Howell. Well, the soldiers arrested Howell and forced him to ski to Mammoth, and on the way, the party ran into park photographer Frank Haynes and nationally known writer Emerson Huff. Haynes took photos of the dead bison, and Huff wrote a very long magazine article about the affair, which was published in Forest and Stream magazine. It's been republished, by the way, my friend Scott Herring, Dr. Herring in California, UC Davis, has republished it so you can now read. It's called Tough Trip Through Yellowstone, and it's got all 15 chapters republished. So we now have it easily accessible. They probably have that book right here, I would guess, if you want to take a look at it. Read the original account of going in to arrest poacher Howell, who wasn't yet a poacher, by the way. So the American public became so angry about this affair that Congress, acting very quickly, passed the Lacey Act in early 1894, an act to protect the birds and animals in Yellowstone National Park and to punish crimes in said park. That law is still in effect today. It established wildlife protection in this nation. And as you know, the states are and have always been in charge of animals. They're the ones who regulate. Montana regulates its animals. So does Idaho, so does Wyoming, so on, every state. And I remember sitting in law school at the University of Oklahoma, trying not to fall asleep at some of the professor's lectures, and being terrified that they were going to call on me, Mr. Whittlesey, stand up and tell us about U.S. versus Jones, while everyone else relaxed because they weren't getting called on, and I'm suddenly on the hot seat. Law school was a terror trip for just about everyone, and still is in most cases. And I remember sitting there, and in criminal law, actually it was criminal procedure, I remember the professor saying, animals are regulated by the states, by the states. And he pounds the desk. Except, he says, in Yellowstone National Park, Wyoming, I immediately perked up, where the feds regulate them. That was the legacy of the Lacey Act, 1894. So the Lacey Act did the following things. It placed Yellowstone under the exclusive jurisdiction of the U.S. It today gives the park exclusive federal jurisdiction. That's the magic phrase, exclusive federal jurisdiction, whereas every place else, it's the states that run the animals. It made it a misdemeanor to kill, wound, or capture any bird or animal in the park, and it imposed a fine of $1,000, at that time a lot of money, and up to 2 years in prison. Today, it's only 1 year if it's a misdemeanor. But at that time, that wasn't there. They hadn't constitutionally challenged it. And so you could send somebody to jail for 2 years for a misdemeanor. And it also allowed them to collect for costs and forfeiture of all property so that the Army could keep Mr. Howell's property, his horse, all of his stuff. Now, the Army had an interesting way of enforcing this with poachers, because what would happen after the Lacey Act was passed and signed by the president, the Lacey Act was in effect, was in force, and then the Army was forced to, you know what, we've got this law, but we're still going to kind of do it our old way, because Captain Anderson liked the old way, and no one was there to keep him from doing it. And what he would do, as he had done before the Lacey Act was passed, was they would take the violator to the boundary of the park, usually a faraway one, and deposit all of his stuff, his horse, all of his accoutrements, his gun, guns, other weapons, knives, all of his stuff right there. Then they would march back through the park to the opposite boundary, depositing him there. He then was not allowed to cut back through the park to get to his stuff. He had to go around. Not good with a lot of snow on the ground. Not good in the summer, even when it's a long darn way, because you see the park is 63 miles north to south and 54 miles east to west. Pretty big. That's how the Army dealt with it. It was extra legal, yes, but it sure sent the message to the poachers. So that's the story of the Lacey Act. Today, of course, it's well supplemented by other laws like the Bald Eagle Act and the Migratory Bird Act, but in 1894, it was the only such law in the books. If you are interested in reading up on this, and it's a lot more than I've told you here, the books are Carl Jacoby's Crimes Against Nature, Squatters, Poachers, Thieves, and the Hidden History of American Conservation, John Reiger's book, American Sportsmen and the Origins of Conservation, and James Trefethen's Crusade for Wildlife, Highlights in Conservation Progress. Those are the three books I'd recommend. And they probably have them all three right here, I would guess. Number six, admission of automobiles. Autos were officially admitted to Yellowstone August 1, 1915. after a number of other national parks had already admitted them, and at least 15 years after most cities in this nation had automobiles plying their streets right alongside of horses and wagons. Where you see the first automobile was invented in 1886 or so, a chain-driven affair that had a stick, not a steering wheel, just a stick. And very quickly they became known as horseless carriages because the naysayers saw it that way. Get a horse. Get a horse, they yelled at those people over and over for 15, 16, 17 years until about 1902 when suddenly there were autos right alongside the horses and wagons in many of the cities of the nation. Out here, of course, in Montana, they were harder to find. Seems like the horse and buggy era lasted longer in places like Montana. So the first automobile to enter Yellowstone legally was driven by Mr. and Mrs. K.R. Sealer of Red Wing, Minnesota. Actually entered the park before the official date. See, this is the problem you have with rangers at the north entrance. Now, they were there, the rangers, even though the Park Service wasn't established until 1916, the following year. They hired some people to run the north entrance station, and they were called rangers because the U.S. Forest Service, established in about 1905, had forest rangers. Our guys were called park rangers, different deal. They do a lot of the same things, but a forest ranger works in the national forests, a park ranger works in the national parks. And so those rangers were there in 1915, and they got a little bit fidgety when they saw a line of, oh my gosh, 20 automobiles literally lined up there. And they got a little bit fidgety, and so they let them in the evening before July 31st. Oops. So technically, they all came in July 31st, 1915, instead of the official date, August 1. And when autos were admitted to Yellowstone, there was an immediate conflict on the park roads. Fortunately, the season was nearly over at that time, so park officials had a year to try to figure things out, right? A year was not enough, it turned out. The summer of 1916 was total chaos in Yellowstone as both horses and automobiles traveled the roads. The car engines with their backfiring, making noise, to say nothing of additional backfiring, scared the horses and resulted in stagecoach wrecks, several of them that year, which injured people pretty badly, especially on the Mammoth to Gardner stretch. The roads were too narrow and hilly for these new automobiles, requiring the stagecoaches to leave 2 hours ahead. That's what we'll do, said the rangers. We must make them go early. That should separate the groups, and that way they're separated. And they won't run into each other wrong. The cars caught right up with the stagecoaches. So because the roads were narrow, all traffic in the park was one way. They required that you sound your horn on hills and at curves so that if there was a carriage coming with horse, that was horse-drawn, they would hear that and hopefully know you were there and maybe they could control the horses. Horses were still frightened. So in short, the summer of 1916 was a disaster because both cars and horses were on the park roads at the same time. So the park tour was motorized in 1917. All stagecoaches were prohibited from the park tour. That is, they still used them for maintenance purposes, fixing roads and stuff. Those continued. Nothing happens instantly, right? So maintenance vehicles using horses were still happening in the park as late as 1931. They're still using horse-drawn vehicles. And, of course, whenever the autos would be stuck in the mud, we would get a horse to pull it out. A lot of interesting history there. The park tour, as I say, was motorized in 1917. Stagecoaches were prohibited from the park tour, and instead most visitors rode the Yellowstone Park Transportation Company's 116 new buses. These buses were really 7 and 11 passenger motor cars, each with its own driver. Thus continued the tradition of having a driver in charge of a group of people, we still have that today, giving the tour. I wrote a book that is called Storytelling in Yellowstone, Horse and Buggy Tour Guides, and it's about the stagecoach drivers and how they gave those tours during stagecoach days. If you want to read more about that, it was a chaotic time, but fascinating, let me recommend Richard Bartlett's article in Montana, the magazine of Western history, dear to my heart, as Montana's wonderful contribution to the history community nationwide. It's got a big reputation.
We should be proud of them.
And he wrote an article in the summer 1970 edition, which is called Those Infernal Machines in Yellowstone Park. I'd recommend it. It's got a picture of Mr. and Mrs. Sealer's car with them driving it. So, number seven.
We're almost done here. Well, we've got four left.
Establishment of the National Park Service in 1916. By 1916, there were 14 other national parks and 37 national monuments in the system, plus Yellowstone. The Army controlled some of these parks. Awareness began as early as 1908 that an agency was needed to run the parks. So they began to debate it, and it took 8 years to get action. The wheels turned, like I say, slowly, and the Army was shortly to be needed for World War I anyway. So in 1916, Congress created the National Park Service. This is what they directed the Rangers to do. They said, you Rangers will, here are the key words, conserve the scenery and the natural and historic objects in the park. Natural and historic objects. And manage them in such manner and by such means as will leave them. Here are the words to remember. And if you remember nothing else from today, try to remember this phrase, unimpaired for future generations. That is the directive Congress gave to the National Park Service. That's what the National Park Service is supposed to do. If they don't do it, they can be sued and will lose. The lawyers got into it, as they always do. And today, if a park is impaired, that's a negligence on the part of the Park Service. So, no park superintendent wants to have a park that is impaired because of that original National Park Act. With those words, Congress immediately equipped the new Bureau with its inherently conflicted mandate, and one which we still have today, that is, how does one protect something for future generations while allowing it to be used and enjoyed? That has been the NPS's burden and debate ever since in Yellowstone and all the other over 400 parks in the system. And it's not an easy task to do this, but hey, Congress never promised us a rose garden, is what I used to say. The Leopold Report, 1963. The Leopold Report issued that year was the culmination of a great numbers of years of scientific study, plus many hard lessons learned on the ground at Yellowstone and in other places. They looked at historic photos and looked back through them. Wow, fires burned here in olden days. It essentially enunciated the formal policy, although the park had been heading gradually toward it for many years anyway, of keeping things natural, right? Quote, unquote, keeping things natural, which at that time began to be called the policy of natural regulation. Now, I think I know what natural means. As one of my ex-bosses used to say, I think I know what natural means, but because his natural and my natural may be different from your natural, or your natural, or your natural, the park does not call this natural regulation anymore. Instead, they use the term ecological process management. Because it became a big debate. You know, what's natural? Are humans natural? I won't go too far into this, because yes, I can do a whole talk on just this. Where do humans fit in? Are they part of nature? And it turns out both sides, I'll give you the short version, both sides say, yeah, humans are part of nature. But one side says, yes, humans are part of nature, so therefore any darn thing they do is fine. And it's natural. The other side, which is the side I'm on, the side the National Park Service took, was that, yes, humans are natural, but you know what? They're quantitatively and qualitatively different from other species because we can fire a missile, a nuclear missile at the moon and blow it out of existence. Elk can't do that. Fish cannot do that. Skunks cannot do that. So, qualitatively different. And today, the term ecological process management is still in use. Last I heard, this report, published as the Leopold Report, was posted in American Forests, if you want to look it up, April 1963. In that report, Dr. Leopold said the following, as a primary goal, we would recommend that the biotic associations within each national park be maintained or, where necessary, recreated as nearly as possible in the condition that prevailed when the area was first visited by the white man. A few things have probably changed today because they weren't all white, obviously. A national park should represent a vignette of primitive America. That was a catchphrase. Still hear it. Vignette of primitive America. If the goal cannot be fully achieved, it can be approached. So today the park has expanded this definition a little to acknowledge the reality that there's no snapshot in time moment that we attempt to imitate in parks, but neither do we throw up our hands and give up on the policy just because Indians were also here. Some of the naysayers have said, you know, there's no such thing as natural because the Indians were here. They set fires. Okay, fine. But we're not going to give up on trying to keep it natural because nature's dynamic, always changing, and what we honor in the national parks is natural processes. Saying that there's no such thing as natural is kind of like saying the moon is no longer natural because Neil Armstrong walked on it in 1969 and left his footprints. There may be some totally natural places left, especially in places like Montana. But even if there aren't, we can approximate that and use it as a model. We can reintroduce wolves, and we've done that. So ecological process management remains the Park Service's philosophy. And part of that ecological process management means that if humans are responsible for the killing of an entire species, if we can prove the species was there, we can reintroduce. That's not without its problems, as all of us have seen the wolf situation. And the skunk, who's going to lead this, reintroduce the skunk back into Yellowstone. So this is not without its controversies. The public or anyone may gripe when animals die during a harsh winter, right? And they used to want to help feed the animals because we had a tough winter and it killed a whole bunch of animals. And isn't this really kind of like running a ranch? Well, no, it's really not. Remember that the death of each animal in a natural place is a gift of life to everything else. When that animal dies, everything feeds on it all the way down. From the consummate predators, grizzly bears and wolves, all the way down to bacteria, all the way down the food chain. We may hear people gripe when lightning caused fires burn forests. We may hear a little more about that in a minute. We may gripe when an animal exterminated by humans is reintroduced to its former habitat, such as wolves. We may gripe when exotic species are purposely killed because they're not natural. Now, that one right there sounds like killing the brown trout out of Duck Lake. The fishermen didn't like that, but by golly, there were brown trout in there historically. So they killed them out of there. That was an exotic fish, which changes that whole lake. That riparian or lake habitat is different because we put an exotic fish in there. Again, these things are controversial and difficult, but nobody, Congress, promised the Park Service a rose garden. And by the way, there are some things that Yellowstone is not. Yellowstone had parks like it. And people get confused about this, so I want to try and clear it up for you. There are three things that Yellowstone is not. It is not a zoo. It is not a ranch. And it is not a garden. No matter how much some people may want it to be. What do you do in a zoo? You fence the animals and put them in cages and you feed them. Do they do that in a keep it natural place like Yellowstone? Answer, no. What do you do in a ranch? A ranch has what's called maximum sustained yield. That's so you can get the most out of the land because that land is a commercial range. That's what I would do if I owned a ranch. Anybody seen the Kevin Costner show, Yellowstone? If you get a chance, take a look at it. It was on all this last season. My opinion, it's worth watching. It's a real slice of Bozeman, Livingston, Paradise Valley, and the park. Kevin Costner is the star. Take a look at it if you get a chance. I think you can probably get it on Netflix even. That's what I would do, maximum sustained yield, if I owned a ranch. It's a commercial range. You want to get the most out of your land because it's feeding you. It's making a profit for you. Do we do that in a place like Yellowstone? Answer, no. Not a commercial range. Number three, a garden. What do you do with a garden? A garden is where humans purposely plant seeds to make them grow and then harvest them as you water them and plants come up. You harvest them as crops. Do they do that in Yellowstone? Answer, no, they're not supposed to. But fairly often the rangers have to go around and tell park employees sometimes, hey, you can't spade the ground up here next to your dwelling and plant a little garden. Uh-uh. Got a problem with exotic plants getting out into the ecosystem. So, is it a zoo? Is it a ranch? Is it a garden? No! A lot of people are confused by that, those three things. So, one of the most important books about these concepts is James Pritchard's book, Preserving Yellowstone's Natural Conditions. I'd highly recommend it. Another one is Paul Schlaery's Searching for Yellowstone, which I mentioned earlier. Highly recommend it. These are, in my opinion, two of the five most important books ever written about Yellowstone. Now, the Yellowstone fires of 1988. This was and is a top 10 event, in my opinion, because it changed the American people's awareness of the role of natural fire in our forests. Wait a minute, natural? How could fire be natural? Well, we know that lightning strikes the earth. I read the statistic somewhere, something like 16,000 times a minute. You're probably not going to be able to put out every lightning-caused fire, no matter that you may try. And people do try. Although Yellowstone had a natural fire policy from 1972 to 1987, it was little known in the nation as a whole until 1988. This is one way to test a policy, said one park official. That would be Bob Barbie, as I remember he said that, who was superintendent of Yellowstone. We're going to test the policy. Oh, brother. Indeed, it was a way to test the policy. President Ronald Reagan had never heard of the policy at that time, and neither had a lot of other folks outside of Yellowstone. By July of that summer, we were in the park. I was there. Full suppression mode. That meant, oh, we got to go to full suppression. So maybe we're not going to try to put the natural fires out, because by that time, there were at least 53 different fires, and it was hard to tell what was caused by a lightning strike and what was caused by guys with chainsaws in Idaho, sparks starting them as they cut wood, or some guy pitching a cigarette. The biggest fires were the unnatural ones, including the North Fork Fire, which was one of the biggest. Eventually, around 25,000 firefighters took their turns at trying to put out the Yellowstone fires. Most of us who were there that summer, myself included, believed that there was simply no way that humans could have put those fires out without the help of nature, which finally came along in September to end what was essentially, arguably, a natural event. As I say, about 53 different fires. Some sources call it 56 fires. Most were lightning caused, but the biggest one, the North Fork Fire, was human caused. And I got to tell you, I would work the information desks as a park interpreter after that for years, and I would stand there in the ranger hat, and up would come. Usually people were really interested, and they just wanted to hear all about it and learn all about it, the fires. But every once in a while, you'd get a guy who was going to lecture me. He was going to tell me what he thought, and that's fine. We want to hear everybody's opinions. This guy in particular walked up, and he said, "You could have put those out. We have the technology. Technology is king here on this earth. We have the technology. We could put those out. I know you could have put those out." And I said, "Sir, I was standing at Canyon, at the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone, which, by the way, is 3,500 feet wide, 1,500 feet deep. And I stood there and watched as the fires came up to the edge of the canyon. And I'm thinking, here we'll get an interesting test, because that's how you put forest fires out, is by digging line and finding barriers to stop the progression of the fire." And as I watched, that fire came to the edge, and as I looked across, all of a sudden I saw boom, 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 little fire after little spot fire starting on the opposite side of the canyon. And I'm thinking, well, so much for that theory. My opinion was they couldn't have put them out. It took a natural event, you know, snow and rain in September. The fires affected more than one-third of Yellowstone, and 63% of the acres that burned resulted from fires that started outside the park, by the way, human-caused fires. And I was there, like I say, in 1988. I remember being struck that summer by all the waitresses, dishwashers, truck drivers, and bartenders who were suddenly experts on forest biology and ecology. Everyone had an opinion, and that's fine. Even those who seem to have no training whatsoever, they all had their opinions. It's okay. Again, Congress never promised us a rose garden. After the fires, park officials and many scientists put their heads together to see whether or not to tinker with the natural fire policy. An interagency panel was convened with experts and public comment. As a result of it and further tinkering that's been done over the years, the park still has a natural fire policy, but it tends to watch the weather and firefighting resources, meaning how many helicopters you got, how much slurry do you have, that kind of stuff. Tends to watch those things a little more closely than before 1988. And they also have a drought indicator, which lets them pay close attention to relative dryness in the environment when they're considering what is called wildland fire use. That is an energy relief component, they call it. And it allows them to be accurately predict fire behavior, we hope, they hope. And it's something that can be tricky because that year, the expert fire folks saw fire behavior they had never seen before. Some of them had been on the fire lines for 35 years, and they had never seen that kind of behavior. They do the risk assessment analysis for each fire on how dry things are, what the weather's been like, how much stuff do we have available to fight it with, all these kinds of things. And it gets kind of complicated. They talk about 1,000-hour fuels and energy release components and things that make my head swim because I'm a historian, not a scientist, but I try to learn it. And, of course, moisture, as you might imagine, is a big factor in that analysis. If you want to read more about those fires, I'd recommend several books. The first book that I'm aware of that came out, George Werther's book, Yellowstone and the Fires of Change, came out in 1989. It's still a pretty good ecological discussion. Micah Morrison wrote a book called Fire in Paradise. I think it's the best discussion of the actual events that summer, although I don't necessarily agree with some of his conclusions. And then recently, Marianne Frank, she wrote a book called Yellowstone in the Afterglow, Lessons from the Fires. And we have a lot of very recent stuff that has been written because of anniversaries of those fires, a 25-year anniversary. Now it's the 30-year anniversary, including more recent books like my friend Jeff Henry's book, The Year Yellowstone Burned, is really kind of fun to read. The last top 10 event was the reintroduction of wolves. It happened the most recently, but it's also been 23 years, 1995. I believe the reintroduction of wolves is a top 10 event for two reasons. Even though it was long somewhat controversial, the event signaled a major change in the thinking of the American people as to how we look at our fellow creatures of the world, including predators, and which ones we're willing to share space with on the globe. And number two, this is an animal that, to quote Dr. Doug Smith, who's head of the Wolf Project, restructures ecosystems. Or, another way to put it is, maybe it's trying to put them back the way they might have been. And that's an iffy proposition because you can't return. Things might have changed. But the wolves have really affected the ecosystem. The experts who looked at possible wolf reintroduction were wrong about so many things because I was there. I remember talking to them. And I remember I was one of the people who was pretty sure, and this is one of the few we got right, that coyotes would become the victims of the new wolves. That's one of the few that we got right. Sure enough, the new wolves begin to dig the coyote pups right out of the dens and kill them. In Lamar Valley, something like 40% of the coyotes were killed just very quickly. Now they gradually come back in. It's been very interesting to personally watch how coyotes that we used to see, one over here, and then it suddenly, after the wolves reintroduced, you'd see 2, 3, 4, 5 coyotes. That really changed coyote behavior. That's fascinating, especially when one realized we probably didn't have great numbers of coyotes in Yellowstone historically, which is what Paul Schilleri's and my accounts show. It appears to us that coyotes moved into Yellowstone from other outside places after the wolves were exterminated. They came in order to fill that biological void. Not to say there weren't coyotes, there just weren't as many as we see today. And I remember going to my boss, John Varley, years ago when we were just starting the research, we were probably 3 or 4 years in. I said, John, we are not finding coyotes. He goes, well, it's a smaller animal, so maybe they just didn't report it. Possibly. Anything from a deer down, maybe they just didn't mention it. One of our people that grew up in Yellowstone, Bessie Haynes Arnold, grew up at Mammoth from 1896 to 1916. And she stated years later in an interview, she said, we almost never saw coyotes at Mammoth during that period. They just weren't there. I never saw them. Fascinating when you consider we see them at Mammoth almost every day today, and even back in the 90s, before the wolves were reintroduced, coyotes were there almost every day. Now, that's an anecdotal, non-scientific piece of information, but it goes right along with the accounts that we found, which show that coyotes didn't seem to be there historically in as great of numbers as later. Another way wolves appear to have restructured the ecosystem is called trophic cascade. Now, I'm not going to go into the complexity of that. You can Google it. There's a lot to trophic cascade. I'll give you the short version. You restore a predator like that, it cascades down through the ecosystem and the effects that it has on elk, on plants, and so on. I won't go into that, but suffice it to say that it looks like the wolves have indeed restructured or started to restructure the ecosystem. And there's a lot to that. They're still studying. Some people poo-poo it. Most don't. At least that's what I'm inferring. That's my top 10.
You have just heard a Wanderlust Friday Forum recorded at the Bozeman Public Library on September 14, 2018, as part of the Our Yellowstone collaboration, featuring Yellowstone National Park historian, now retired, Lee Whittlesey, discussing the top 10 events in the history of Yellowstone National Park. Friday forums are free and open to the public each second Friday of the month from noon to 1:30. September through May at the Bozeman Public Library. Thanks for listening and for supporting your community radio station, Gallatin Valley Community Radio, streaming on the web at kgvm.org, your audio mirror for Gallatin Valley and beyond. KGVM Bozeman. Please go to the kgvm.org website and click on the red and gold donate button. We are entirely dependent on your financial contributions in order to bring you the eclectic programming of music and locally produced programs of community interest and concern. We thank you for your support for your community radio station. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LeClaire, with assistance from Steve Durbin in Bozeman, Montana, for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.